Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is local sports dietitian Ricky Keene. Besides discussing sports nutrition, we'll be discussing dieting and other common nutritional concerns. So why don't you give us a call or make comments by calling us at 550-8433 if you're in Anchorage. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email us at line1@kska.org. Ricky, it's nice to have you here today.
Thank you.
I've never had a dietitian. I've been doing this 10 years. We've done some nutrition stuff, but you're the first dietitian.
Wow.
And you've got an interesting history. Or what you do anyway sounds interesting. I don't know what your history is, but I know what you're doing. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I do live here local, in the local area of Anchorage. However, I do work outside of the state. Multiple times throughout the year, kind of depends on what I'm pulled in to do with some of my contracts. But I teach at the University of Alaska. I teach a sports nutrition class. Class has just started today, so very excited about that. I do some clinical work. Hasn't been as much because the sports nutrition, basically the jobs, have taken up a lot of my time. So I do work Alaska Regional at times, as well as contract out. Through my private practice, down to ESPN or Disney's Wide World of Sports in Orlando. Also contract with BP, so I go up on the slope, try to help them out with their nutrition. BP's really, really promoting the wellness and health aspect now, as well as consult and scientific advisor for a beverage company called FRS Healthy Energy.
You forgot to mention, what got my attention is your NFL connection. Or maybe I didn't give you time to say it.
That's pretty much it. I'll keep it simple, I guess.
Tell us about the NFL connection a little bit.
That is actually, we have an NFL training facility down at Disney's Wide World of Sports. And through the off season is when our vets and our NFL guys come in, because there really is no off season per se. They always try to keep their job, so they got to train throughout the year. Then we also do an NFL pre-draft combine camp. That's very intense through January and February before they go off to Indianapolis for the combine. So that's where we get our top NCAA athletes and train them for their job interview of their life.
So what's the combine? Maybe everybody doesn't understand that. And what's the nutritional aspect of this?
The combine basically takes around the top 300 NCAA football players. They go and get tested. There's 13 different aspects that they test. Probably the one that gets most watched through the NFL Network on TV is either the bench press, or probably the number one is the 40-yard dash. Mm-hmm. So everybody's interested in speed. And that's what we do a lot with we have a lot of the top speed guys that work with us at Disney, Chris Johnson, Ike Taylor, those kind of folks. So we basically, with the combine, we just get them ready. We train them as if, you know, it's basically an ultimate test. They also do some interviews with the coaches, the scouts. There's actually an intelligence test that they do. And they're on the spot for sure. So as far as nutrition goes, we need to make sure that they recover well, because it's pretty intense training coming from college into the pros. So we get them prepped and ready. Make sure they look good. Make sure they're fast.
So you use the word recover well. What do you mean, and where does nutrition come in for recovery?
That's probably one of the top effects of nutrition is with recovery. So within 30 minutes, especially when we're working out they are working out 6 or 7 hours intensely throughout the day, 5 to 6 days a week, recovery is really, really important. So within that 30-minute window, matter of fact, they're so trained now that as soon as they walk out of the strength room, they're grabbing something out of our fridge. That's the time that the body is going to soak up and really utilize the nutrients to the optimal level. So you can jumpstart recovery, jumpstart reloading the glycogen, your fuel, muscle damage can start actually repairing, start to minimize, and then so you can really be ahead of the game come the next morning, because there's really not 24 hours for them to recover. So it's really, really important.
Let's bring that point down to anchorage and recovery. And I'm thinking in particular of my experience with my daughters in soccer tournaments, where they may play three or four games in 3 to 5 days, and sometimes two games a day. And I've tried to bring up the issue of recovery as I learned about it. And is it important then, too?
Yes, it is. Yeah, if there's going to be multiple events during the day, there's going to be multiple days, the intensity level is going to play a factor along with the duration. So, yeah, it's vital that they go ahead and take advantage of that golden opportunity, that window that we sort of speak of is within that 30 minutes. But I usually say as long as your heart rate comes down, you're able to put something in your system, if you can do it within 15, 30 minutes, your body, your hormones, your enzymes, everything's ready. It's like a sponge. And you're basically, and then you also need to have your next meal in about 2 hours after that. So you want to jumpstart it and get that process started.
How do we know that there's that window that's important?
Research and lots of it. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very conclusive, very, very well known that it's been well proven. So
what should go into your body during that recovery period that's pretty well documented?
Great question, because that's where research has really dialed in and finalized, well, what is it? Does it have to be all carbs? Does it have to be all protein? What happens when fat's involved? Really, it's high amount of carbohydrates in general. Our rule of thumb is approximately 25 to 50 grams of carbs immediately or soon after. Typically simple sugars. So this is where you want to have, you could have juice. You want something to go fast into the system. But they've also found along with that, it's beneficial to have some protein. It doesn't have to be some of these huge amounts in some of these protein shakes, but it can be as little as 10 to 25 grams of protein. And that enhances actual repair as well as fluids need to be there. Depending on the person, some sodium as well, because the sodium will help drive the sugar into the muscle cell. It also helps the fluid. So it all kind of, it's a synergy, basically a team effort on all parts.
I'm going to take my medical experience and see if I can help people understand why those particular things are needed, and you correct me.
Okay.
So the carbohydrates, what we use is we have some readily available glucose all the time. We store it as in the form of glycogen in our liver when we use up our glucose. And so one of the things is we need to get some more in because we've used a lot up.
Yep.
And with exercise, we actually are injuring muscle. Muscles have a lot of protein. The protein is to help repair that damage quickly, which you'd mentioned. We dehydrate. We're burning up. We're breathing hard. We're sweating. We're losing water by evaporation. That's how we lose weight rapidly in a short period of time. And then sodium is an electrolyte that's extremely important for, and we'll lose loss during sweat and so forth. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it may also help the glucose. So that right?
Yep. Yep.
And so the drinks that are important, as you've mentioned, is that carbohydrates, which are sugars, have complexity and simple, and the glucose is the simple one. And so most of these drinks are primarily glucose?
There'll be a mix. Actually, there'll be sucrose, which is your table sugar. So you're looking at a fructose-glucose combination. There's the same word, which is dextrose. There's multiple simple sugar words that they'll put on a label. Another one is a maltodextrin. Maltodextrin, your body treats it like a simple sugar. It's very short chains of glucose, so it's going to be absorbed rapidly. However, there is some marketing misinformation that can be used, and they will, because it's not a one or two unit glucose compound, which makes it a simple, it's actually 3 to 20 units. So now it goes down in the category of complex. Well, but your body treats it like a simple. So there'll be some mismarketing on that and say, hey, we got complex carbs in our sports drinks. Mm-hmm. I just ignore it. Mm-hmm. Maltodextrin's a good thing. It can actually make the product less sweet for some folks as well.
So give us some specific names, trade names if you need to, of these, and things that people may get their hands on that are similar and useful that you can recommend.
Well, there's the good part of having multiple sports products out there is options. Once you've kind of know your taste, which would probably be number one, but meeting your needs, most of the sports drinks can. But it's also individual. Once you get past the taste, the product that you're going to like, then you really need to look at, you know, the carbs. How many carbs is it going to provide me? What concentration if I'm going to mix it in a powder? That can be very important for your GI. Sometimes people learn the hard way that it's too concentrated, that you also don't want to dilute it as well. So I've had a lot of people say, okay, well, I'll take Gatorade, but I'm going to dilute it. Well, you're not getting as much carbs. And there is some science behind these sports drinks. Same thing with sodium. If someone's a heavy sweater or a salty sweater, the sports drink might not, in most cases, won't give enough sodium. So that will have to be supplemented in. So as far as names go, you know, obviously Gatorade's a pretty well-known name. Other ones, you know, Powerade, Powerbar, actually just came out with one. It's very similar to what they have now, but it's Endurance Formula or Iron Man, and that's a higher sodium one. So those are probably the most common. Other ones do have some protein in them. So there's EFS. There's also Pure Sport. There's also Accelerade. Those are the ones that would have the protein in it. Mm-hmm. My favorite, if my athletes are out there, know that EFS is my favorite.
Do all athletes, let me put it this way, fairly high-performance athletes, I'm talking, I don't know, I guess I'm thinking certainly marathoners, professional athletes, triathletes, and so forth, who are working out consistently and rather hard, do they all, in your mind, really need the protein, or is it somewhat individualized?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. So the science has gotten to the point where it really does make a difference, and particularly in muscle injury repair, which is happening when we're doing all this.
Absolutely. Even in endurance athletes. And so just associating protein with bodybuilding or muscle growth is definitely needed as well with endurance athletes. And it could be dependent. I could adjust that along with their carbs according to the time of the year, especially for a triathlete if they're off season or their early season of base. They could have different nutritional needs than they do when they're at intense levels.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Ricky Keene. Ricky's a local sports dietitian. And we're talking about, right now we've been talking about sports and high-performance nutrition, but we're going to get into some other issues that are more common to those of us who are not so active. And you're welcome to call and ask questions or make comments. Let me give you a couple of contact numbers. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us during the program at line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Ricky, tell us a little bit about the difference between nutritionists and dietitians. What's the difference there?
That's a good question. One that dietitians kind of have to basically define a lot, especially for our scope of practice. But a dietitian can be called a nutritionist, and this may make a little bit more confusing for the public, but a nutritionist cannot call themselves a dietitian. A couple of the key differences between the two is that you know if someone's a dietitian, they're going to have set academic standards that they have had to meet to be a dietitian. First one being a bachelor's degree, so a minimum of a four-year degree, completing a 9 to 12 month internship, which is something we have here at UAA, along with a new nutrition degree that we're very excited about, a bachelor of nutrition. The other things are completing a national board exam and maintaining continuing education hours. Now, a nutritionist, that's a very vague term. It can be used by anyone. So you really don't know the background. You really don't know their education. Not to say that they are not good, but there's a more risk there of what kind of information that you're going to get. where a dietitian is going to give you information based on evidence. So things are, there is evidence-based knowledge. We're going to look at science and research. We're not going to look at the latest fad or the trend or what a supplement company tells us in an ad or a magazine article. We're going to base things on science. So it basically, we're going to give more of the unbiased view in a sense. So that's some of the key things. A nutritionist, you can get that certification online. And someone called themselves a nutritionist. It can cost a minimum of $70 to $600. Take a week course. I know a colleague that actually tested one of those programs online, sent in the money. They sent this very, very simple test, and she signed up her dog.
So it's a little bit, it's a significant amount of reassurance that this person who is a dietitian has been significantly trained and passed some testing that substantiates that they know what they're talking about. And virtually anybody could say, I'm a nutritionist.
Correct.
The bottom line here.
Yep.
Okay, we've got a caller. Let's go ahead and take our first caller. Katie, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you so much, Dr. Woodard. And this is Katie Moran, and I know Ricky. I have the pleasure of working with her.
Hey, Katie.
She and I learned a valuable thing because she was helping with me with the MS bike ride a few years ago, and some people do like to eat peanut butter when they're My question, Ricky, is, and I haven't seen in a while, and I'm going to look forward to that in the future, is there any way of finding some source for us non-athletes that has this good information?
A resource?
Right.
Is that, you? yeah, exactly. Well, besides, going to see a dietitian, just some good resources online.
For some of us that aren't really ill health at the moment but are out of shape and can't get insurance to pay for seeing dietitians,
well, and that's actually a good point right there is, unfortunately, insurance for preventative and health and athletes, that's usually not covered. So that's a good point. There either has to be a renal or a diabetic or a disease state to have that covered. So unfortunately, and maybe in the future that will change, eatright.org is an excellent website. That is the American Dietetic Association, and they will actually provide some wonderful, unbiased, good, evidence-based, reputable links as well. There's also some nutrition facts on there, like fact sheets. We actually recommend, instead of reinventing the wheel, if somebody even works at a gym or a hospital and they want to be able to use those fact sheets, they sure can, because we want to get the right message out, the right information. So that would probably be one of the best places to start.
Another.
I just want to say one thing to promote dietitians is they do so much for patients and people.
Thanks, Katie. We shared an office. We had fun.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
I've often gone to... The Harvard School of Public Health has a nutritional website, and I have interviewed the head of that program. So I don't know if it would maybe I don't remember the specifics of the website, whether it gets into sports nutrition. Are there sports nutrition websites that are?
There are, but in general, I like excellent ideas as far as Tufts as well.
Okay,
both Harvard and Tufts have some excellent websites. And as far as in further into to sports nutrition, the organization that falls under the American Dietetic Association is a subgroup. That's where a lot of the sports dietitians' colleagues basically kind of funnel to. And that would be the SCAN, SCANDPG.org, SCAN.org. But that will actually link, if you go to the eatright.org, that should link you to SCAN. One of my favorites is actually the Australian Institute of Sport. I think they have some really some good fact sheets as well, and some good information. And those are going to be the websites that are going to provide some evidence-based advice.
Since we're talking about the evidence-based thing, there's a couple of issues that maybe, well, I want to break up. Maybe we should break up, but I just, I'm constantly trying to get people to recognize. And somebody told me recently, we were, maybe it was on this program, somebody interviewed not too long ago and made the point that media, yes, it was, Dr. Strasburger last year, and last week, he made the point that media is education. And I never thought about it like that. And the point is, media as an education is suspect because quality evidence does not have to be there. In general, often the media is somebody's trying to sell you something, and they generally don't tell you the whole story, whereas university-based websites and so forth have no real bias in general. We all have a little bias. So is that worth commenting on?
Oh, absolutely. I think besides our food industry and the media, we've kind of presented and really created this perfect obesity storm, in a sense, and some of these health issues. And I really do think media has a play in that. So, you know, the headlines sell, and they're going to sell, you know, whether caffeine is bad today or it's good tomorrow. And actually, that just happened today. I got an email with a research that caffeine, they were looking at caffeine to affect arrhythmias in female from the Women's Health Study, and found out that it actually benefited these women at moderate doses. So something they weren't looking for. But it's always one piece of the puzzle. And what the consumer, the public doesn't know is they're not going to go look at that article in that journal and understand that, one, it wasn't even in humans. Mm-hmm. It was in a test tube. Mm-hmm. Or was it in mice? Or, you know, so sometimes you can't make that leap into humans. Or what population was it? And I think one of the biggest ones that just amazes me that's made billions of dollars is the arginine. And the years ago with the study of IV arginine given to congestive heart failure patients at large doses showed some benefits for those patients. So it opened up their blood vessels. These are patients that aren't healthy. So from that leap, it went all the way to bodybuilding, to a healthy population. Yeah.
Testosterone in adult males is the same story.
So know, it's
very, very similar story.
But yeah, it's media. And then there's been studies where they show, you know, hours of watching TV and what are we seeing, you know, as far as food. And they compared it to they watched 84 hours of primetime TV, 12 hours on Saturday. And noted, according to our government recommended dietary allowances, were we matching that, the message? And we weren't. There was over 2,000 percent of the RDA for fat, 2,500 in regards to sugar. We only met 30% of the RDA for fruits, vegetables, and dairy. So there's definitely a mixed message there. You always see the fast food commercials, the fruit roll-ups, you know, and then they'll promote an excellent source of vitamin D, you know, in Fruity Pebbles.
It is, but then it also gives you twice as many calories as you need to get it.
Yeah, right. So it's, you just have to maybe turn off the commercials. I don't know.
Yeah. Dr. Strasburger's comment is we just need to all be more media literate. I kept saying that's just part of being good and critical thinking and understanding how we know what we really know. And we have to test things to answer that question. We're getting close to a break. I wasn't sure how I wanted to do this. Let's start just by talking about basic dieting principles. What do people really need to understand if they're interested in a diet and losing weight?
The healthy way, a long-term success way, unfortunately, is not as exciting as a quick fix, as being told what to do, when to eat, how much to eat, per se. But it really boils down to eating healthy. And 80-90% of the time, realize it's not perfect, but you can have your cake and eat it too. I think it boils down to, you know, how often are you having that cake? How big is the cake? So I think people just realistically need to have some patience and understand that a good, healthy way to lose weight is going to take time. and exercise. It really, those are two major components that, that need to work together. And I think that if I was to say a secret to make it more exciting, I say the secret is consistency.
Mm-hmm.
That is the biggest thing, is being consistent. There's going to be some days that are different than others. That's fine. But overall, being consistent, making the best healthy choices that you can.
So it's all an energy in, energy out issue. And what you're saying by consistency, at least what I'm hearing, is that if you take in a little bit less than you need for a couple of days and then you splurge and have a big pizza on the weekend, you're about energy neutral. It's the consistency of it.
Right.
Of consistency of taking in less calories than you're burning up. Really is what it boils down to.
And you could break it up into, watching, if you're eating healthy most of the time, you're going to bring down the sugars. You're going to bring down the saturated fats. Try to stick to more of the whole foods, more of an apple than an apple juice type thing for most of the time. But I think in carbs get really bashed. And there are times that we don't need as many carbs. But it's the type of carbs. We've gotten out of that, there's that portion distortion. And, a bagel now from 20 years ago, there's a huge difference. The amount of pasta, rice, those are all great things. But a half a cup of pasta is not in the mindset of someone that's going to be serving themselves. It's the plateful of mm-hmm. pasta. So I think we do have to pay attention to carbohydrates and the types, making higher fiber choices, but also leaner proteins and healthy fats as well. I think we should definitely go more that route. So it is a calorie in, calorie out, but there is a difference there with the quality of calories besides the quantity.
Does the kind of quality that you eat ever been shown to substantially change your hunger, or lead to greater satiety?
Sure.
Are there tricks related to better nutrition in that aspect?
I have to give away my tricks for free. Yeah, there is. There definitely is.
I didn't know we were going there. Okay.
Fiber.
Okay.
Fiber's great filling agent. It's not going to give you calories, for one. But if you think about where fiber is, it's in very nutrient-dense foods. So you're getting a lot of not just the fiber, but antioxidants, fruits, vegetables, whole grains. So a lot of nutrition comes with that fiber. You do have to look for the whole grain. There are some labeling tactics out there you have to be careful of. Whole grain is not a multigrain. Little things like that with the labels. And protein. Those are the two things that I would advise somebody. It's the lean protein sources that we need to look at. But I think one of the biggest factors is our typical American breakfast is probably close to 90% all carbohydrates. And a lot of them are probably closer to the simple carbohydrates. And that can really start that roller coaster ride of insulin resistance through the whole day. So I always try to advise my athletes or my clients to have a protein in the morning, have a lean source. This morning I had veggie sausage. I also have whey protein and actually mix that with my coffee. It's a vanilla flavor. It makes me feel like I'm having a fancy coffee. And whey is very satiety. It's a lean source of protein. You don't have to do it every day. But you get tired of eggs or you get tired of the veggie sausage. You can have peanut butter, just because of the healthy fats that will give some satiety as well. So I'd say the biggest thing is try to have, not just all carbs in the morning. And a little bit of milk on the cereal is not going to be enough of the protein.
So. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a short break. I want to remind you, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433, 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to take calls and emails and talk with Ricky Keene about nutrition on Line 1, your health connection.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, we're discussing nutrition with sports dietitian Ricky Keene. We've talked about some high-performance sports. We've talked a little bit about some basic fundamental nutrition, and we're kind of getting into diets, and maybe we'll talk about vegetarian diets and people who want to be vegetarian, what's good and what's bad about that, and some other aspects that you may lead us to if you've got questions or comments. So give us a call. Or email us. You can email at line1@kska.org. Our phone number locally, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening tonight, which we'll record at a repeat at 9 p.m., it's a re-recorded rebroadcast, and we won't be taking phone calls or answering your emails at that time. So if you've got comments or questions, you need to get on the phone or on your computer and email us right now. So what else do we need to talk about with diets? You want to make any comments in general, or do you want me to lead you down the primrose path about diets?
That's an open question, open loaded question. There's so many diets.
To me, there's a lot of misconception of the basic principles you just got talked to. I talked through. Everybody seems to think their diet works great, yet they don't last very long, and they usually are not any better than doing it the right way, which is a little bit more slow and consistent.
Correct, or they're worse off than they started.
Oh yeah, and then there's some problems too. You're right.
Yeah. Didn't go as planned, I guess. At times, it sounded like it sounded good on paper.
Yeah.
I'd say one of the ones there's a lot, and some come back around, which should be kind of a red flag that if they didn't work the first time with one generation, they're probably not going to work the next. Is the HCG diet. That just is amazing to me, the whole process, the whole concept of it. And with that is HCG being the female hormone, there's two parts to that diet is you inject, into the muscle, the hormone, at a certain dosage, or you take the HCG hormone orally through drops. So the key though to that is, you're also following a 500 calorie or less diet or intake a day. That is very, very low of amount of calories. That lasts for 40 days. That would be the first phase of the diet. There are rules, of course. You can't exercise, which is probably a good rule when you're
500 calories.
When your tank's empty, you probably don't want to go too far too fast. So probably more of a safety rule in that diet than anything. Then there's a second phase, which is 21 days. You do get to go up to 1,200 to 1,500, and there's, of course, some rules there as well. And then, of course, after that point, you weigh yourself every day for the rest of your life. I think that is a little bit of a turnoff right there and could lead to some issues. But there's absolutely, back in the 50s and 60s when this came about with this diet, there's actually no proof, no science that it works. And there's matter-of-fact science that says it doesn't work. And when I say that, I'm talking about the HCG part of it, has no effect. But sure, anybody that's on 500 calorie diet is going to lose weight. And if they don't, there's probably something wrong. And,
right.
You know, so there's that. I totally can't deny that people are going to lose weight. I do think knowing how the body works, and of course you too, is how can one person, their claim is 1 pound of white fat. So the body can actually, with this HCG, differentiate between brown fat, which we had very limited stores of as an adult, versus white fat. You actually claimed that you'll save all the brown fat, you only lose white fat, and you don't lose any muscle. So when someone loses enormous amounts of weight on a short time, there is absolutely no way they have to lose muscle. So until research comes to support that statement versus a testimonial because their family did it, I'm going to have to hold out and believe in into the diet.
So the bottom line on the HCG diet is that there is no evidence that HCG contributes to extra weight loss in somebody taking a 500 calorie a day diet. It could be dangerous.
Correct.
Just taking the HCG. People say there's no side effects. There's nothing without side effects. Two, it's going to cost you more money. For doing that. And three, 500 calorie a day diet is probably something that ought to be pretty strict medical supervision and has got some risk by itself. Assume you're a typical woman and needs 2,000 calories a day. You got a 1,500 calorie a day deficit. You ought to be losing a pound every 2 days or so, roughly on that, is the way I would figure.
Yeah, and it's going to be muscle
You're not going to spare the carbohydrate because you can't make any more carbohydrate.
No, in a fantasy world, maybe this would work. You just can't tell. You can't tell or overthink and outsmart the body.
Yeah. It's going to, once it runs out of carbohydrate and glycogen, it's going to start breaking down fat and protein to make energy. Yeah. There's no other way around it.
No, that's just how the body works, and we have stacks of research to show that.
Okie doke.
So
let's see. We've got a couple of callers. I got to look at my thing here. Let's go with Mike, I guess, is the one we need. Mike, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I topped out about 310 pounds when I finally decided that I got to figure out how to lose weight. And one of the things I did was I ended up going to I was looking at the radical surgery route, stomach stapling and other things. And I decided to better try something different. My doctor didn't want me to necessarily do that. So I went to a consulting or what do you call a counselor type in Anchorage, Premier Health. And it's been very successful for me. But one question I had of the lady there was related to metabolism. One of the things they required me to do is eat three meals a day, sometimes four, which seems to be a pretty substantial effect on me for some reason, and I'm assuming, and I don't know the answer to it, and that's the question is eating a meal in the morning and more multiple meals seem to keep the engine running and the body from storing fat, or what is the effect of that?
That is true. It can boil down to calories in, calories out. But ideally, to have quality in a sense of body composition and making sure that your insulin levels and your sugar levels aren't chasing each other is not to have long periods of time between meals. As you know, if we go 5-6 hours without a meal, most people, their blood sugars are going to drop. You're going to get cranky, possibly headaches. The body's saying, hey, because one, the brain only wants to run on sugar. Says, I need something to eat. So it's going to have you eat. And a lot of times we don't always make the best decisions when we're really hungry. Probably because the brain is doing what it normally does. And so you can't really fight it at times. So then we tend to overeat. And then what happens is the sugar levels are going to fly up. The insulin's going to follow. And it does the best thing it can is it's going to store it as fat. Because it may give a feeling that, hey, there may be 6 or 7, 10 hours next time. It's nice to kind of stoke that fire, that metabolism, say every 3 hours, every 4 hours.
Well, that's exactly what I did, and it's worked great for me, and I hope that it stays off. I lost 60 pounds in the last 8 months, and I just want to make sure year after year it stays off.
Yeah, Mike, it sounds like you're really getting very good advice, and so with those four meals a day, I'm sure there is some quantity or caloric
no question.
That has to be readjusted downward, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I do a calorie count off of it. So I started off every day with about 1,400 calories in my bank account. And because I have an iPhone, there's an application, MyFitness, and I just sit there and all I do is plug it in. It's like a cash register. When I start running it out, I know that I'm running out. So if I got enough... you know, I know exactly. And what's nice about it, it forced me to understand what the meals are when I go to McDonald's and have a Caesar salad with chicken, with or without croutons, or with or without the cheese on it. And, you know, all of that works really neat. It's gave me a tremendous lesson and understanding of how many calories are out there that I'm stuffing into my body or used to stuff into my body.
And I think hopefully down the road, in some states have started already, it hasn't really hit Alaska, but you can see it just as close as the Seattle airport if you go there, that they'll start putting in restaurants that have more than 20, you know, mainly the chain restaurants, are going to be having calories on the menu. Whether it's on top of the board or, you know, a menu that you're going to open. And I think that's going to help people really double check what they're... Yeah, so I think hopefully that will come our way. But I you know, there's plenty of great apps out there. I really like livestrong.com.
Right.
So if you're at the computer, but there's many out there, free.
Yeah, I just happened, I fell in the habit of using MyFitnessPal because it does have a capability. Every time you plug in something and you say a particular type of restaurant, if it's a restaurant chain, it'll give you the information on each of the meals. And that's the best thing I've run into.
Well, keep at it. You're doing great.
Thank you very much for your advice.
Yeah. So two things that I'd maybe comment on that Mike did is one that you'd said before, he was consistent or he's been consistent. And two, you'll learn to change your habit in that you can get by with less quantity and you don't have to be hungry. I think so many of us are just in a habit of eating X amount or something. And it's like riding a bicycle or something else. It's a very hard habit to dislearn, but can be done.
And I think with society and every fast food restaurant and the portion sizes, the media, what we see in regards to commercials, I think we've kind of trained ourselves to like fat, to like sugar, to like sodium at high levels, almost to where it's like a need that we have to have. The brain triggers, you know, like a drug, we have to have it. Well, we can actually, with patience, be able to change those taste buds, because we do get new taste buds. Just need to be patient. You know, over time, you'll be able to not want to tolerate so much sodium. You'll taste something and it's too salty. Something's too rich, so your portion size goes down. So you can train the body to like healthy foods. We just have to be patient and consistent.
Helen, you're on line one.
Oh, hi, this is Helen.
Yep.
I'm calling from Seward, and I really like to lift weights, and I've started taking a whey protein supplement, and it says it's 100% pure, and I wonder what you thought about that, if it's beneficial.
Why are you doing it? What's the
purpose?
The purpose that you...
Yeah, well, I had a friend that told me that it was a good idea, and I don't eat a lot of meat, and so I thought, well, maybe I need more protein.
Okay. So it's a way to make sure you get enough protein, as if you're a vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian. I just don't eat a lot.
I'm just trying to bring in two subjects at one time. Okay,
well,
all right.
I lift a heavier weight, and so I thought, well, you know, maybe it's a good idea.
Yeah. You're going to bulk up on whey. Okay, all right.
Well,
I don't want to bulk up, but I don't want to be low on my protein.
What I would do is kind of determine, not knowing your body weight or some of your goals, is in general or in your intensity of what you're doing. I'm assuming you're not doing, you know, low reps and, you know, high volume powerlifting.
I am, actually.
It's intense then.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's definitely some muscle damage going on. So for repair and maintenance and immune system and enzymes and all those things that are great for protein, sure, it's good to get enough in. And so what you want to do is kind of basically take your kilograms. My brain thinks in kilograms, which is about half of your body weight.
Okay.
Okay. And then go anywhere from, say, take that number. We're just going to make it simple math, is 50 kilos. So if someone's 50 kilograms, anywhere from, 1.2 to 1.8. So if you want to fall in the ballpark of 1.5 grams per kilogram, that would probably put you into a sufficient amount of protein, not overdoing it. I would not recommend going over 2 grams per kilogram. So, that's kind of ballpark. I'd say really no more than 100. You can get it from food for sure.
Okay.
But if you know you're not getting it from some lean protein sources, I think doing whey is fine. I do have a lot of my athletes use that because we're looking at leaner sources. But remember, some of those wheys out there, some of their serving sizes are enormous. One of the ones I've used in the past, it's a great flavor, it tastes good, it mixes well, is the GNC Amp. But if you look at the package, it says 3 scoops, which is their 1 serving. That's 60 grams of protein. There's absolutely no need to do 60 grams at one time of protein. So something in the ballpark of 15 to 20 grams at one time, when you're really not having other protein sources with that meal, or low amounts, that would be fine. So it's a good substitute.
Yeah, I tend to put it in my smoothie after I work out. And this is 1 scoop is 28 grams. I don't know if that.
You could probably do half to 2/3, that kind of thing. So it depends on what other, I think in that ballpark of 20 to 40 grams at one time is a nice number of protein. Your body's only going to use and assimilate so much protein. So some of these folks that are doing 100-gram protein shakes really have kind of wasted half of that protein.
Are there any signs that you're getting too much protein or not enough? Are you tired?
Well, if you are taking in more protein, make sure you're taking in more fluids because it is going to it can dehydrate at large amounts and cause more stress on the kidneys because the kidneys are trying to filter it through. But that would be pretty high amounts. I think if you stay in that 100-gram ballpark, give or take, that would supply plenty of protein for you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep.
Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Here's an email. This one relates to calcium and dairy products. So a couple of sentences, I got to put them together. It says, I have a question regarding what appears to be a catch-22 that exists between consuming calcium through milk products. Yet then the women excrete calcium in the urine because of the high level of protein in the diet due to the milk products. Why don't we hear more about that? That's one question. Second, it seems like a lot of women are wasting their time eating yogurt, cheese, milk that actually works against them. Friends of mine have often been surprised to learn that there's very little osteoporosis in Asia where women consume virtually no dairy versus the United States where women consume large amounts of calcium but still have issues in the U.S. where there's lots of calcium. So you understand the question there? Okay.
The amount of protein that it would take to draw calcium out of the bones is incredibly high. So I would not worry about that. And I think more so to worry about getting the best or the most absorption out of calcium is making sure your vitamin D levels are appropriate because that is going to be a regulator for your calcium absorption. So keep your protein, moderate, even if it is moderate to high. It is not going to draw the calcium as long as you're getting calcium in as well. So some of those studies or some things that if you heard, it's usually a very high amount of protein that was put into the body and very low levels of calcium intake. So then that had negative effects on the bones. So as far as, the mixture of being in milk, there's no problem. And as far as the soy products or something, tofu, very, very popular. And I think it was Japan. Was that the?
She was mentioning that Asian women may not take very much dairy and have no osteoporosis versus U.S. women drink lots of calcium but still have osteoporosis.
Well, part of that is they can still get the calcium from other food sources, even from, vegetables, from spinach, broccoli. They may not be the best absorbed, but that's definitely if they're consuming a lot more of those. And tofu as well is going to provide calcium. So So maybe also their red meats, their high protein intake could play a factor. But again, it would have to be some enormous amounts of protein to affect that.
There's some other reasons why osteoporosis may be different in different areas, too. The amount of vitamin D, perhaps women get in Asia, but also activity is very important for osteoporosis. The people who go up in space, the astronauts, have a tremendous problem with calcium loss without gravity, and so it just shows you how much important activity is. Athletes are able to prevent osteoporosis, but then as Ricky's mentioned, you've got to have significant enough vitamin D to get the calcium absorbed in the first place. So there's a number of reasons why there may be differences. Whether that's true or not, that women in Asia have less osteoporosis, I don't know. All right, so let's take another question. Looks like Delissa's been waiting the longest. Delissa, what can we do for you?
Yes, hello. My name is Delissa Renadeo, and I live in Wasilla. And I just wanted to talk about the benefits of a 100% plant-based diet, a vegan diet, whether it's from the perspective of maintaining a healthy weight or disease prevention. I know that in terms of the program earlier was talking about the importance of fiber and so forth to help people maintain a weight loss, and that is so true. You know, when we have a diet that's high in fiber and high in water, like fruits and vegetables, those fill you up. Reason, like she said, they're so very much nutrient dense, and so they're low in calorie density and high in nutrient density, which is a perfect combination for good health. So I just wanted to put in a plug for the plant-based diet, and there are more people learning about that. There are some Food for Life classes offered in Anchorage and the Valley that are teaching how to prevent and reverse cancer and diabetes and obesity and so forth through a plant-based diet. So I know you had mentioned earlier that she was going to, you know, bring up the subject of vegetarian or vegan diet. So okay. I'm introducing that.
All right. Well, let us let you take this off the air, and we'll address the issue of what we know about vegetarian diets and health. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right.
You can definitely get all your nutrients in through a vegan diet. However, it does have to be planned. So there needs to be, you know, where you're going to get your calcium, where you're going to get your zinc, your B12, your vitamin D, of course, which I think all of us probably need to supplement anyways. But all these kind of things do need to take into effect. So someone's going to do this, it is healthy. But if they're going to do it, they need to make sure that all these areas that they may not be getting in, being 100% vegan, then, you know, no dairy, eggs. Eggs are high in choline as far as the egg yolks, so there's wonderful things that we'll be missing there, but they just need to be replaced. So if I know athletes that are complete vegans, and they do completely fine. Performance is great. You can build muscle. You don't have to have meat. So there is some, as a choice, yeah, it can be done. I just make sure with my clients that, some of those gaps that may be missing, we make sure we fill.
In vitamin, my understanding is children can be raised with a ovo-lacto vegetarian diet. But the issue of vitamin B12, and this was before the vitamin D issue came up, was an important one. Where do you get vitamin B12 in a lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet?
you get it from meat.
Okay.
supplements. It is fortified in soy milk.
Okay. Okay.
That would be the choice.
So you got to be careful. No matter what you do is part of the issue, and be sure you're talking to someone who knows what they're doing.
Yep.
The other question that Delissa brought up that I'd like some comment on, do we know for sure that a vegan diet is healthier than a non-vegan diet?
We actually don't.
Uh-huh.
There's mixed information, and that's usually what we get in the headlines. You know, One day it's the savior. The next, it's not. I saw, I think it was last year, that there was a study, and I can't really comment exactly the details of the study or if it was even a good study. But again, it was headlines, and a student had brought it up to me, and it's just one little study, so it's not like I put a lot of faith into just one. But it showed that the vegan diet, someone following a vegan diet, their brain shrunk. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Yeah. I don't, you know, maybe we start out with a fat brain and we need it to shrink. I don't know. So cognitive, was there a difference? I don't know. So there's all kinds of, you know, there's mixed data on that.
I would say that if it was clear that vegan diets were better, that we would be hearing a hell of a lot from our government.
Well, yeah. I would hope.
In the health field, that this is important.
Absolutely.
I mean, certainly it's being looked at, and certainly we may argue that we eat too much of the wrong kinds of meats and
right,
all
the
this.
Saturated fats.
But the whole bottom line is, pretty early in civilization, humans learned to use fire, and fire helped them actually get
survive.
Calories in. Yeah, also it broke down the meat. It took less time to digest. Yep. It took less energy to free them up to do other things. So we've been eating meat for a long time. So not to say that it's not one day we won't discover that it's one's better than the other. But at this point, I think that question remains open.
It's definitely a personal decision on either camp. I think the concern with going complete vegan is if someone does it because it's trendy or their friend's doing it, they need to make sure that they know what they're doing and what areas that, you know, B12 or calcium and zinc that would need to be filled. But it's still out there whether it is that much more beneficial. And there's something that recently came out which was, I don't say disappointing, but I'm still not going to change my diet over there, that fruits and vegetables may not be all that in relation to decreasing cancer. Of course, that's, you know, one... Mm-hmm. One review that came out, but I still think and believe that there's just a lot of benefits to doing fruits and vegetables than, you know, a greasy cheeseburger mm-hmm. That we know that's going to increase, you know, triglycerides mm-hmm. and cholesterol. But even just because somebody is vegan, they still can have high cholesterol levels. They still can have a heart attack. They doesn't necessarily mean that their complete health. So it's definitely a personal decision to do that.
Several very, very famous vegetarians who promote a diet of cancer. So anyway, I think we need to keep an open mind. There needs to be a hell of a lot more research done on this whole issue before we can really promote one better than the other. Oh, Ricky, it's already, the time is up. Thanks very much for the time. Maybe
You're
we
welcome.
Need to do this again. I want to apologize to Carolyn, who's been holding on the telephone. We never have gotten to her. We'll be back next week, and we'll be talking to the current head of the United States Preventive Services Task Force, Dr. Ned Kalong. We will discuss the task force's recent controversial breast cancer screening guidelines and also what they do, as well address your questions and comments. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. Thanks for listening, especially those of you who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.